Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments you can hear Joan Knows. Joan Lewis, EWTN's Bureau Chief here in Rome, brings us the Vatican Week in review. But first, we join Jill Bevilacqua, who presents this week's edition of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. It begins, as always, with Sean Patrick Lovett reading this week's Gospel for us.
The sisters of Lazarus sent word to Jesus to inform him, "Lord, the one you love is sick." Upon hearing this, Jesus said, "This sickness is not to end in death. Rather, it is for God's glory, that through it the Son of God may be glorified." Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus very much. Yet, after hearing that Lazarus was sick, he stayed on where he was for 2 days more. Finally, he said to his disciples, "Let us go back to Judea." When Jesus arrived at Bethany, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went to meet him, while Mary sat at home. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would never have died. Even now I'm sure that God will give you whatever you ask of him." "Your brother will rise again," Jesus assured her. "I know he will rise again," Martha replied, "in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus told her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he should die, will come to life, and whoever is alive and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?"
"Yes, Lord," she replied.
"I have come to believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, he who is to come into the world." Jesus was troubled in spirit, moved by the deepest emotions. "Where have you laid him?" he asked.
"Lord, come and see," they said.
Jesus began to weep, which caused the Jews to remark, "See how much he loved him." But some said, "He opened the eyes of that blind man. Why could he not have done something to stop this man from dying?" Once again, troubled in spirit, Jesus approached the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across it. "Take away the stone," Jesus directed. Martha, the dead man's sister, said to him, "Lord, it's been 4 days now. Surely there will be a stench." Jesus replied, "Did I not assure you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" They then took away the stone, and Jesus looked upward and said, "Father, I thank you for having heard me. I know that you always hear me. But I have said this for the sake of the crowd, that they may believe that you sent me." Having said this, he called loudly, "Lazarus, come out!" The dead man came out, bound hand and foot with linen strips, his face wrapped in a cloth. "Untie him," Jesus told them, "and let him go free." This caused many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did to put their faith in him.
At a time when email and even telegrams were centuries away in the future, two sisters sent a telegraphic message to Jesus of 7 words. "Lord, the one you love is sick." There was no need to elaborate. He would understand immediately. And this brief message, which led to this last great miracle before his passion, brings to mind those 4 words spoken by his mother, leading to his first miracle in Cana, "They have no wine." But before we even consider the miracle of the raising of the brother of Martha and Mary, our natural curiosity pushes to the fore all kinds of questions. Who were they, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, the brother who only appears as a resurrected body and as a guest at a dinner? We don't know anything about him. Was he tall or short, thin or fat, dull or witty? What was his relationship with his sisters? and a fairly obvious question, what did he die of? One thing we do know, though, our Lord loved him, which should be enough for us. The evangelist certainly thinks so. As for Mary and Martha, we've already met them, and their personalities are clearly etched in Luke's account, where Martha is distracted with much serving, while Mary sits at our Lord's feet. Still, one would like to know something more about this family. Are they all about our Lord's age? 30-ish? Is Martha perhaps the eldest, and was she ever married? Mary we're never sure of. Was she Magdalene? We know she anointed the feet of Jesus at the house of Simon the leper, also in Bethany, where Martha again is serving, and Lazarus, raised from the dead, is one of the guests. Certainly, Jesus was very close to this little family, and it is to their house that he goes most often, as if it were a second home. There's a description by travel writer H.V. Morton of the view from the Mount of Olives, which must have been very familiar to Jesus as he went back and forth between Jerusalem and his friend's house in Bethany.
The Mount of Olives is slightly higher than Jerusalem and stands up, therefore, like a screen between the city and the desert land that falls to the Dead Sea. From the top of the Mount of Olives, the view looked like a photograph of the mountains of the moon, an apparently sterile world of brown, domed hills piled together, bare of vegetation, and falling rapidly into the hot distance where a streak of blue marked the waters of the Dead Sea. Beyond the blueness rose a barrier of brown hills streaked with violet shadows. They were the mountains of Moab. This was a view that Jesus knew well, and it's not altered since his eyes gazed upon it. He saw it when he came over the hill from Bethany. The golden age of Israel was in the desert, and I wondered as I looked down on the silent, dead hills whether Jesus loved to sleep in Bethany because after the wrangling in the temple court, he could catch a glimpse, as he crossed the Mount of Olives on his way back in the evening, of the calm, desert place, dedicated forever to God.
And Bethany, a village about 2 miles east of Jerusalem, described by Morton, writing in the 1930s, as a little Arab village on a slight hill, a huddle of houses that looked like ruins, and ruins that looked like houses. And this huddle, he goes on, stands on the spot which Jesus knew as Bethany, the home of dates. There's no doubt at all that this is Bethany. But although tourist guides may point out Mary and Martha's house, as our writer comments, it cannot possibly be authentic. All one can say is that somewhere on the hill is the house in which Martha, Mary, and their brother Lazarus lived. Incidentally, the modern Arabic name for Bethany is El Azareh, a form of Lazarus or Eleazar, a very common name at that time, meaning in Hebrew, God helps. And so to our miracle, and to an unusual interpretation of the feelings and thoughts of our Lord on this occasion. Here is The Raising of Lazarus, written by German poet Rainer Maria Rilke in the early 20th century.
One had to bear with the majority. What they wanted was a sign that screamed. Martha, though, and Mary, he had dreamed they would be contented just to see that he could. But not a soul believed him. "Lord, you've come too late," said all the crowd. So to peaceful nature, though it grieved him, on he went to do the unallowed. Asked them, eyes half shut, his body glowing with anger, "Where's the grave?" Tormentedly. And to them it seemed his tears were flowing, as they thronged behind him curiously. As he walked, the thing seemed monstrous to him, childish, horrible experiment, Then there suddenly went flaming through him such an all-consuming argument against their life, their death, their whole collection of separations made by them alone. All his body quivered with rejection as he gave out hoarsely, "Raise the stone." Someone shouted that the corpse was stinking, buried now 4 days ago. But he stood erect, brimful of that unblinking, mounting gesture that so painfully lifted up his hand. No hand was ever raised so slowly, so immeasurably, till it stood there, shining in the gloom. There it slowly, clawingly contracted. What if all the dead should be attracted upwards, through that siphon of a tomb, where a pallid, chrysalid thing was writhing up from where it had been lying? But it stood alone, no more replying, and they saw vague, unidentifying life, compelled to give it harbouring.
From this very individual impression to a comment by Sheed, "Nothing is stranger in the story of the raising of Lazarus," he writes, "than Jesus' own reactions, his weeping and distress, his sighing and groaning." But his tears could have been prompted at the sight of Mary weeping, and the knowledge that Martha too was grieving in her own way, while he himself had lost a dear friend. But we're also told, more than once, that he was troubled in spirit, moved by the deepest emotions. What were they, these emotions? "There seems no doubt," writes Sheed, "that he was praying to his Father for the power this miracle of all miracles needed. For when it was on the point of happening, he said, 'Father, I give thee thanks that thou hast heard me.'" We might wish now to take a look at the tomb where Lazarus had lain for 4 long days. But that surely is to miss the point. He has returned to life. And so let's listen to the voice of the protagonist himself, in the words of a contemporary poet, Peter Redgrove. Here now is an extract from Lazarus and the Sea.
I could say nothing of where I had been, but I knew the soil in my limbs and the rainwater in my mouth, knew the ground as a slow sea, unstable like clouds and tolerating no organization such as mine in its throat of my grave. The knotted roots would have entered my nostrils and held me by the armpits, woven a blanket for my cold body, dead in the smell of wet earth, and raised me to the sky for the sun in the slow dance of the seasons. Many gods like me would be laid in the ground, dissolve and be formed again in this pure night among the blessing of birds and the sifting water. But where was the boatman and his gliding punt, the judgment and the flames? These happenings were much spoken of in my childhood and the legends. And what judgment tore me to life, uprooted me back to my old problems and to the family, charged me with unfitness for this holy simplicity?
The thoughts and feelings of Lazarus on returning to life can only be imagined. But there's nothing fanciful in the stupendous dialogue between Jesus and Martha, which took place before the miracle and which is on record for all time. H.V. Morton exclaims admiringly,
"How marvellously St. John takes up the brush and fills in little details of this character study. 'Lord,' began Martha in her usual blunt way, 'if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died.' Then, revealing the real depths of her soul, she says, 'But I know that even now, whatsoever thou wilt ask of God, God will give it thee.' And it was to this depth of faith in Martha that Jesus spoke those words that have brought comfort and hope wherever a man or a woman has stood above an open grave: 'I am the resurrection
and the life, he said to Martha.
Many thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for yet another edition of There's More in the Sunday Gospel than meets the eye. She'll be back again at this same time next week. Time now to join Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome. In a few moments, she'll be giving us a bird's eye view of this past week in the Vatican. Joan, let's begin with Sunday's Angelus, shall we?
You know, just looking back, though, at the whole week, we usually do begin with the Sunday Angelus, but this was such a full week. We could sit here and just list what the Pope did on Thursday, and we'd be halfway through the show. The Angelus, again, drawing, you know, record crowds to St. Peter's Square, and the Pope dedicated the Angelus, as he always does, really, to the readings of the day, to the reading and mainly to the Gospel. So, of course, last Sunday was the story of the blind man cured by Jesus. He said, the apostle, whose gospel this is, narrates the event in just a few words, really. It's his intention to attract attention not to the miracle, but to the questions it raises. And the Pope said, you know, many times a good act, in this case a healing, a work of charity, causes gossip and questions from people who don't want to know the truth. The cured blind man is interrogated by the astonished crowd, then by the doctors of the law, and nobody believes him. And even his parents, you know, tell that, yes, he was born blind and now he can see. But he gets faith. Through his healing, he attains faith, the highest grace that he receives from Jesus. So basically, even more important than being healed. Sundays are, unless the Pope goes to a parish in the afternoon, he's done that on occasion. And we learned from Cardinal Vallini the other day, the Cardinal Vicar of Rome, that when he first met with the then new Pope Francis, and the Pope was talking about visiting Roman parishes, Cardinal Vallini asked him to visit the parishes that had not yet received a visit from a Pope. That is what we are looking at. And John Paul visited, all but maybe 20 of the 320-something Roman parishes. Other than a parish visit, Sundays are quiet. I guess the Pope always is preparing for the next day. And in fact, on Monday was incredible. Monday, the Holy Father met the Salesians, and in talking to them, their founder, of course, Don Bosco, Don meaning Father Bosco, the Pope highlighted their work, which is a continuation of what Don Bosco founded, the charism of the order, for work with the young and schooling and education. And he highlighted Father Bosco's preventative system, which helps these young people in their commitment and living with them. He said it's necessary to prepare young to work in society in the spirit of the gospel as workers for justice and peace, and to live as agents of the church, which really isn't that what all of us have to do. Then on Monday, three canonization-related press conferences. There was one in the press office basically on preparations in Rome and in Bergamo, of course, where John the 23rd lived there, studied there, was born nearby in Sotto il Monte. In the afternoon, mid-afternoon, Sky satellite television and CTV, the Vatican television, had a presentation of what's going to be an amazing canonization day because there will be television in 3D. And so the Mass will obviously be seen around the world. And then the third press conference of the day was about the release of a book of Pope John Paul's poetry. Cardinal Vallini said that what he wanted to stress was the fact this is an event on spirituality and holiness, and 5 million faithful are expected in Rome. This is according to the Rome Task Force. Now, Father Lombardi for the Vatican said he was dealing mainly with the area around the Vatican. So St. Peter's Square, Pius XII Square before that, and then Via della Conciliazione.
Right up to the Tiber.
Right up to the Tiber, which he said could accommodate 250,000. But we know right now they're going to be setting up mega screens all over Rome. We don't know the precise location yet, but millions are expected. I believe it's 1 million alone from Poland. And interestingly enough, just to mention for a moment, there was a priest, Father Della Vite, from Bergamo, from the Bergamo Diocese. They have three very interesting initiatives. Two initiatives from Bergamo regard Haiti and Albania charitable works that they are going to finance there. And then the third, they have asked all 900 priests of the Diocese of Bergamo to give a month's salary on Holy Thursday to the diocese in order to finance a lot of events. I mean, just think about the impact of that. Then Tuesday, of course, the Holy Father met with the heads of all the Vatican offices, the dicasteries, and basically there was no press release on everything that was being said. We do know that the Pope was asking the heads of the departments to discuss the reaction to and how are they implementing his apostolic exhortation, Evangelii Gaudium. It takes us to Wednesday, to the general audience. There were more press conferences. One, I just have to say this in 20 seconds, there is an amazing exhibit on Bibles called Verbum Domini 2.
In the Charlemagne wing, to the left of St. Peter's Basilica, of the left-hand colonnade.
This is a must, and folks, if you're in Rome, you're hearing this right now, and it's a very beautiful exhibit. I've forgotten the hours, but, you know, 9 to 6, 10 to 6, something like that. Except on Wednesday mornings, it's closed because of the audience. But speaking of Wednesday, Pope's audience, general audience.
His catechesis on the sacraments continued.
That was a day of two momentous things. His words on the sacrament of marriage, which were so beautiful. And Wednesday was April 2nd, which, of course, was the 9th anniversary of the death of Blessed John Paul, very, very soon to be St. John Paul. And the Pope did mention that at the audience. But he began by talking about marriage. And he told married couples they should never let the sun set on an argument. They must make peace, remembering to always say, three key words of his pontificate, to always say please, thank you, and sorry. He had very beautiful words to say about marriage, and he said, you know, the real wedding gift you get is the fact that your marriage is a reflection of the triune God. And the love among the triune God, it's a reflection of the Holy Trinity. And then, of course, the Pope joked, as he loves to do, and these are the sound bites you always remember. He said, you know, you don't need to call the United Nations to your home to make peace. He said, just a small gesture is enough, a caress, and tomorrow is a new day. And then he quoted, of course, Father Patrick Peyton, who said, and I think people around the world have quoted him for decades, the family that prays together stays together. And then Thursday, a big day for you and for the Pope and the Queen. So she actually flew in and back to the UK, London, on the same day. She had been invited last year by Italian President Giorgio Napolitano to come for a visit. Yes, indeed, 87. To come for a visit and to have lunch, and she had accepted. Then a flu overtook her, and she had to cancel that particular engagement. And so they reworked that to happen this year. So she flew in, had lunch at the Quirinale, a very impressive event when you see all the Quirinale guards. I think they're the tallest men in Italy. Then about 3:20, her motorcade.
She was late and apologized to the Pope.
Her first words to the Pope were she was sorry she was late. But it was cute the way she said it. I'm so sorry I'm late, but I was having lunch with the president. Can you imagine you and I saying to someone, so sorry I was late, but I was having lunch with Pope Francis.
I was having a good time.
Yeah, having a great time. And so then they got to the Vatican, she and her husband, Prince Philip, and a small entourage. And it was very interesting. It was a very low-key visit. Nothing in the Apostolic Palace. It would have taken her just 20 minutes to go through all the procedures to get up to the fancier rooms. So they met in two rooms, actually, the papal study in another small room off of the Paul VI hall and audience hall, and the amazing gifts they exchanged, hers in particular.
Well, she brought a hamper from her various estates. And she pointed to all the produce, and she even had eggs in the basket and honey. And of course, Prince Philip dug out the whiskey and
naturally, yeah. And that was the most photographed item of this hamper. Was huge. You could have hid three people inside of it. It was immense. And then the Pope gave her a lovely gift, two lovely gifts, but I loved the one for 8-month-old Prince George.
Yeah, she said, oh, thank you, the prince will love this present. And maybe when he's a little older, she added.
Yes, sir. But a sphere,
sphere, which was connected to St. Edward the Confessor. So it was a kind of ecumenical gesture.
Yes. And there was an event earlier in the day which was fairly important. There were a lot of events. I mean, Thursday, the Pope had a mass at the Santa Ana, an audience with the bishops of Rwanda, and he's meeting bishops as we are talking now. He had an audience with Cardinal Omato for the promulgation of decrees for the causes of saints, which I'll bring up. Another audience with the Prime Minister of the Republic of Cape Verde. Telegram for the victims of the earthquake in Chile. He, of course, wrote a daily tweet, and then the afternoon visit with the Queen. So it's like, oh, you know, catch your breath after this. But interestingly enough, in the morning, when he met Cardinal Angelo Omato, who is the prefect of the Congregation for Saints, for the Causes of Saints, the Holy Father named three new saints without the canonical process, like he's going to do for John Paul and John the 23rd. This is called an equivalent canonization. So he named François de Laval, a French bishop, the first bishop of Quebec, Canada, and José de Anchieta, a Spanish priest, Maria de la Encarnacion, French. These three today now are saints. They may be venerated in the Universal Church. And this equivalent canonization process means that the Pope waives the usual judicial process and declares that a blessed liturgical cult be extended to the Universal Church. So up until yesterday morning, these three people were blessed. And now with the stroke of a pen, the Holy Father, this is allowed, obviously, the Holy Father created them as saints without going through the whole process of a second miracle, proving this, proving that, a group of doctors, theologians, etc., looking at this person's life and the miracle. So, and we must state that Pope Francis did this for the canonization of an Italian, Angela Foligno, in October of last year, and also Peter Faber the Pope's very birthday of December 17th. So, and then audiences like this, they have them several times a year. I think it's three times a year that the Pope meets the head of the congregation, causes come up for miracles or heroic virtues, the various different steps one must take. You go from venerable to servant of God to blessed to saint. And then there's a lot of things in those steps, and the Pope merely jumped over a few of those processes. So we have three new saints this week, and two in coming weeks, which we're getting ready for.
You were listening there to Joan Knows, presented by Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome. Our thanks go to her. She too will be back again at the same time next week. That brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we won't be back again at the same time tomorrow, but we will be back again at the same time next weekend. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.